From WNYC, this is The Sporkful.
My name is Melissa. I'm from Virginia. The black side of my family is from South Carolina. My mom is 100% Russian Jewish, but she didn't cook much before she got married, so everything she learned from my grandmother. So she's been cooking African-American food for about 60 years. And I know it's Thanksgiving in my house when you smell all kinds of yummy African-American foods. We have cornbread, the ham, the turkey, the collard greens, and definitely the mac and cheese. You can also smell candied yams, definitely with the marshmallows on the top. We do rice a lot more than we do potatoes. Rice and gravy is one of my favorite things.
Hi, I'm Andrew from Boise, Idaho. I know it's Thanksgiving in my house when I'm eating my grandmother's spaghetti. This spaghetti is spaghetti noodles, shells, elbow noodles. I think she just puts in whatever she has. And it's those little translucent cut-up onions that have been cooked maybe for too long and are kind of squishy. And ground beef, everything kind of stuck inside one dish. And then it's a ton of Hunt's ketchup, never Heinz, and American cheese slapped on top. My grandmother passed away less than a year ago, so this coming Thanksgiving will be the first Thanksgiving without her. And the fact that she's gone obviously hits home, but the fact that the spaghetti part of that equation is also gone is a lot more real, I think, now.
This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman, and we just heard a few Sporkful listeners who called us in response to the question, how do you know it's Thanksgiving in your house? We'll hear more of those calls later, and we'll make a call to the Butterball Turkey Talk Line. It's all part of our crusade to get you pumped up and ready for Thanksgiving. By the time we're done with you, friends, you're going to be asking your family to stay over an extra night so you can cook them an extra turkey. Or veggie duckin', as the case may be. That's right, I said it. We're going to talk about Thanksgiving for vegetarians later in this show. Plus, I try to cook dessert with On the Media's Brooke Gladstone, and everything goes wrong. I mean, just imagine everything that can go wrong in a kitchen. That's what went wrong. But let's begin at the beginning. Turkey cookery. By the way, I love the word cookery. I want to bring it back. Help me out. Now, if you're doubting whether you can pull off Thanksgiving dinner, chances are the turkey is at the heart of your anxiety. And I should say, I myself have only cooked 3 or 4 whole turkeys in my life. My wife and I just bought our first house. We've only hosted one Thanksgiving. So I feel like I'm also just getting the hang of it. And so far, I've been a briner. I submerge my turkey in a saltwater brine, and it comes out delicious. But I'm curious to learn how a brine actually works, like on a scientific level, and also to find out if there might be a better alternative. So it's time now for a semi-regular feature here on The Sporkful that we call Nerding Out. Beep, boop, 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 beep, boop, boop. That's our sound effect for nerding out. It's homemade. Joining me now to nerd out on turkey is Kenji Lopez-Ault, Managing Culinary Director at Sirius Eats. He's MIT educated, he's a trained chef, he loves to eat, and his food lab column is just a must read. Hey, Kenji.
Hey, how you doing?
So one option that has increased in popularity in recent years is turkey brining.
Right.
Not a new concept, but it's...
Not a new concept. It goes back a long time. Yeah.
There's also dry rubbing.
Mm-hmm.
Some people just season and they baste throughout.
Mm-hmm. Some people do nothing at all.
That's right. Now, I want to go through each one of these techniques, and I want you to help me understand how they work.
Why don't we talk about, first of all, what brining is exactly?
Yeah, please explain to me. I'm a turkey. You just dropped me into a bucket of cold water.
Salty water.
Right. What is a brine, first off?
Yeah, well, so a brine is a solution of salt and water. Your typical brine will be anywhere in the ballpark of, say, 3 to 6% salt by weight. So that means, you know, if you have a liter of water, you're going to be adding, 60 grams of salt? 6 grams? 60 grams of salt.
You're the scientist
like
here, Kenji. I'm counting on you to carry the one.
I forget my units. I use the calculator for all that. Anyhow, if you drop a bird into plain water, it is going to absorb some of that water, about 8 to 10% of its body weight or so. And that'll happen whether it's a chicken or a turkey or a duck or any kind of meat, really. Once you start cooking it, that water is going to very rapidly come out again. Muscle proteins contract when you cook them, and they squeeze out liquid. So they squeeze out its own internal juices, and it also squeezes out any water that is absorbed. So in order to get that liquid to stay, you use a brine. And what a brine does is that the salt in the brine actually dissolves some of the muscle proteins, mainly a protein called myosin. And by dissolving that protein, it looses up those muscle fibers so that when you subsequently cook it, they don't contract as much. So your bird is able to maintain more of that moisture. And if you brine a bird and cook it properly, it can retain anywhere from 10 to 13% extra moisture as opposed to what it would have without brining. But the disadvantage of brining, of course, is that generally that extra weight that it's carrying is all just water weight. So by gaining juiciness, you're also diluting flavor.
Turkey flavor.
Turkey flavor, exactly, yeah.
Can I brine in other liquids? Can I just use stock?
You can, but the reason brining works and the reason salt is able to work its way into the meat is that salt is a very, very small molecule. It's sodium and a chloride. That's it. Most aromatic compounds, organic compounds that you find in stock that make it taste good are really large molecules, and they're not charged the way that salt is. So what happens is that when you're brining a bird, it's almost as if your muscle fiber in your turkey is like a subway car, and there's a limited number of seats on there. And the salts are really pushy, and they really want to get in there, so they'll shove the bigger molecules out of the way.
They're kind of like that little old lady with the cart.
Yes. And they'll push other molecules out of the way to get that seat. And once the subway car is full, then there's no space for anything else. So
whereas like garlic powder is just sort of like, oh, I'm going to wait for the next
one. Right,
right. Am I right that one of the advantages of brining, especially for less experienced home cooks, is that it gives you a wider margin for error?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's really the main advantage.
Brining seems to me it's sort of like the equivalent of like performance enhancing seasoning because it's like a turkey. What's the number one complaint people have if they think a turkey's not good?
Dry.
It's dry. Dry. Right.
Yeah.
So you're basically like pumping it full of extra juice.
Exactly. Yeah.
And most people, when they bite into turkey, if it's juicy,
mm-hmm.
they're going to like it.
They are. Yeah. Even if that juiciness comes at the cost of some of the flavor. Now, personally, what I do is called the dry brine. It could also be called a cure or just simply salt rubbing, which I feel offers you a better balance between retaining juiciness while also retaining flavor. I find that a wet brine, sometimes it's overkill. It makes the turkey almost too juicy, and it gives it a sort of like ham-like.
Too juicy? Did those words just come out of your mouth?
Well, it's a question of what do you want in your mouth, and I want all the juices that are coming out of the turkey to taste really strongly of turkey. When you're doing a brine, the juices coming out of the turkey taste like tap water. So what you do is you take a turkey or a chicken, you rub it with salt. I use kosher salt, but you can use whatever kind of salt you'd like. And then you let it sit basically overnight or up to a few nights in that salt rub.
How much salt is a thick coating?
I generally liken it to if you've just seen like a snow flurry on an empty parking lot. You want to be able to see the turkey underneath, but you want there to be like a definite light dusting of salt all over it. I would say for a typical 10 to 12 pound turkey, you'd want about 2 tablespoons of kosher salt sprinkled over the entire surface.
So the turkey's sitting in the fridge,
mm-hmm.
covered in salt. Mm-hmm. What's happening to it?
So what initially happens is that salt will pull out some of the moisture of the turkey.
That sounds terrible.
Yeah, it sounds terrible, right? It's through a process called osmosis, which you probably remember from fifth grade science.
Yeah, I remember AP Bio, Mrs. Daner.
Yep. So what happens is the salt dissolves in some of the liquid on the surface of the turkey, creating like a really hypersaline solution on the surface of the bird. Initially, that'll draw some of the juices out from the turkey. It behaves actually very much in the same way as the brine. Eventually, as that salt dissolves some of the muscle proteins in the turkey is then able to reabsorb that liquid along with some of the salt with it. And so over the course of a few days, that salt will actually sort of slowly work its way deeper and deeper into the bird, relaxing muscle fibers as it goes. So in the end, you end up with an effect that's very similar to brining, which is that the muscle fibers don't contract as much as you cook them, but you don't have any of that excess water added to it. So the turkey is able to retain more of its natural juices.
So it's the same level of tenderness that you get with brining without the performance-enhancing juiciness.
Well, you get more juiciness than an unsalted turkey because the muscle proteins don't contract as much once you cook them. So, you know, if you imagine a turkey's muscle fiber is sort of like a tube of toothpaste, when you cook it, you're basically squeezing that tube and all the liquid's coming out of the end and evaporating into the oven or maybe dripping down into the roasting pan. So what the salt does, either in a brine or in a dry rub, is it basically just weakens the grip on that tube of toothpaste, so you're not squeezing it as tightly. So with the brine, you're actually adding liquid into there. With a salt rub, all you're doing is preventing liquid that's already there from coming out as much.
You're reducing juice loss.
Exactly.
See, I actually enjoy the process of the brining.
Uh-huh.
I agree that it's inconvenient at times, but I went out to the hardware store, got one of those big 5-gallon plastic buckets.
Right.
I leave it in the basement. I wash it out before I put the turkey in it. And I just, part of my Thanksgiving ritual is the rearranging of the fridge.
Right.
That's like part of the tradition to me. It's kind of a fun sort of refrigerator Tetris.
right.
that you play, moving the shelf. I always have to take a shelf out, moving things around, burying things, putting things in a cooler sometimes in the garage.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. One trick you can actually use to get extra crispy skin is another one that doesn't quite work if you're brining. But if you're dry brining, if you mix a little bit of baking powder in with your salt and spread that over the surface of the bird, let it sit uncovered in the fridge for a night or two, you can actually look at the difference in the skin, and you'll see that it creates these kind of micro blisters in the skin that add a lot of surface area and a lot of extra crunch.
I'm going to need to do that.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk a bit about basting.
Uh-huh.
Controversial issue in the food science community, Kenji. I grew up with my mom basting. That uh-huh. was part of the ritual. She would need help taking the turkey out. I used to love to baste. I think the baster
yeah, it's a lot
is
of fun,
a
right?
fun
yeah.
device. And I also think, as I've suggested, I like the turkey cooking experience to be sort of momentous and time-consuming and involved. I think that's part of the fun mm-hmm. of the holiday for me. So the idea of just putting the turkey in the oven and then not doing anything for 3 or 4 hours, it's like,
right.
what else am I going to do besides take it out and poke it and prod it?
Exactly. No, I think that's where basting actually came from, is that you just had to have something to do while it's in there.
But if I'm basting the turkey, am I actually accomplishing anything?
Well, one thing you're certainly not doing is adding more moisture to it. If you go back to our toothpaste tube analogy, when you're cooking your turkey, you're putting pressure on that tube, you're squeezing things out, and you're really not going to be forcing anything back, and there's certainly not by pouring it on top. Mainly what you're doing is regulating the surface temperature. So it can be beneficial because it helps your turkey cook a little bit more evenly, and that in turn can lead to more internal moisture at the end because you're not going to be heating up the exterior.
Okay. Another controversial issue in turkey cookery mm-hmm. that I want to get your take on is cooking the bird upside down. Some people say that when you cook the bird right side up, the breast is on the top.
Right.
Breast tends to be the driest part of the turkey.
Uh-huh.
And over hours in the oven, the juice flows downward because of gravity away from the breast, and the breast dries out. If you cook the bird upside down for at least, let's say, half the time, mm-hmm. juice then flows down into the breast and helps to juicify the breast. Is that true?
Well, okay, so the part that is true is that if you cook a turkey right side up in a standard roasting pan, the breast will be drier than if you cook it upside down. The explanation as to why is incorrect. It's got nothing to do with gravity. And when your breast is facing up, it doesn't have the protection from the roasting pan that the bottom of the turkey does. So when your turkey breasts are facing up and are exposed, they end up cooking a lot faster than when they're upside down. Of course, that also means you get crisper skin when they're facing up. So again, it's a trade-off there between upside down and right side up. What I do, if you're not too set on having that perfect Norman Rockwell, completely intact, plump, juicy turkey at the centerpiece, the best way to cook a turkey is to spatchcock it, to cut out its backbone and lay it flat, splay out its legs, press down on its breast so that it's flat.
Like butterflying it.
Butterflying it, exactly. And you can get your butcher to do that for you. So you know the difference between light meat and dark meat, breast meat and leg meat.
Sure. I know that dark meat is better.
Right, well.
But we want people to continue to think that white meat is better so that there's more dark meat for me.
And the reason dark meat is better is that because it can withstand higher cooking temperatures without drying out. So, you know, the problem is that you have one bird and you have two different target temperatures you're going for. And the way we traditionally cook a turkey with its breast exposed, we're actually exacerbating that problem because the breasts end up cooking even faster than the leg meat does. So by butterflying the turkey and laying it flat, you'll notice that the thighs and the legs that used to be most protected with a whole bird are now the most exposed parts. So with a butterfly turkey, you can put it into a really hot oven, 450 degrees. It'll cook in about half the time that a normal turkey takes to cook. And the breast will end up finishing cooking at just about the same time as the thighs and legs finish cooking. And then beyond that, you also end up with all of the skin on top of the bird. So that by butterflying your turkey, you get the most evenly cooked meat, you get the juiciest meat, and you get maximum crispiness.
Kenji Lopez-Alt, Managing Culinary Director of Serious Eats. He writes the Food Lab column, which is just a must-read for anyone who wants to learn about cooking and eating. Kenji, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I gotta say, I think Kenji may have won me over. I think this year I may try the dry salt rub. Maybe I'll even spatchcock it, too. I mean, all that is a little riskier. I don't get the same margin for error I get with the brine, but I think I might be ready. I think I might be ready. Coming up, what happens when a couple is arguing over how to cook the turkey and they call the Butterball Turkey Ladies to play referee? Well, I'll call the hotline myself and find out. Plus, Thanksgiving for vegetarians, and On the Media's Brooke Gladstone and I try to cook dessert together and everything goes wrong. I mean, everything.
Stay with us. Welcome back to The Sporkful from WNYC. I'm Dan Pashman. And hey, friends, want you to know that we have a bunch of Thanksgiving recipes and Thanksgiving-related videos up now at sporkful.com. So check out the site to help you get equipped and fired up and ready for Thanksgiving. As I said earlier, we asked Sporkful listeners to call in and answer one question. How do you know it's Thanksgiving in your house? Here are a few more of your responses.
I'm Chase from Los Angeles, and I know it's Thanksgiving in my house when my mom is making her famous sweet potatoes. So ordinarily, you think of sweet potatoes with the marshmallows on top, but these sweet potatoes are mashed with cream cheese, about a half a stick of butter, and then they're topped with blue cheese, which is totally just throws everything out of whack. You know, this is one of those foods that even though we only eat it once a year, we spend the rest of the year thinking about it and wishing that we could eat it.
Hi, Dan. It's Janie, your wife. I know it's Thanksgiving in our house when you've been drinking since about 9:30 in the morning, but mostly I feel like I know it's Thanksgiving in our house when the kitchen is pretty much off limits to everyone except Dan after 9 a.m., and the house smells amazing all day. But seriously, Thanksgiving is a great holiday in our house. It's one of my favorite days of the year. I know, Dan, that you get really excited and plan the meal for a long time, and it definitely pays off. Dan, you make a great Thanksgiving meal, and everyone has a great time getting together and eating delicious food.
Oh, that's nice. Thanks, sweetie. Although, I have to say, I don't know that I start drinking that early, do I? I mean, I think I usually wait until at least 10 before I pour my first drink. But I do love a drink on Thanksgiving. I love a drink when I'm in the kitchen cooking all day. In fact, in last week's show, Rosie Schapp, New York Times drinks columnist, gave us a drink called the Autumn Bonfire. That recipe is at sporkful.com. What I love about all these calls is that they show me that there are so many different ways to celebrate Thanksgiving and to incorporate different cultures into Thanksgiving traditions. And some of the ways people celebrate Thanksgiving don't even involve turkey. Have you guys heard about this? I guess these people are calling themselves vegetarians? That doesn't sound right. I'm kidding. I know what vegetarians are. In fact, some of my best friends are vegetarians, and joining me now is one of them. L.V. Anderson is Slate's food and drink editor and is herself a vegetarian. Hey, Laura.
Hi, Dan.
So what do you people look forward to eating on Thanksgiving?
Everything except for the turkey. That's my basic answer.
What about you in particular? What are the highlights for you?
Stuffing is a personal favorite. I wish I could eat it more often, but I also know that typically only served once a year is what makes it so special.
And so you don't feel like you're missing out at all on Thanksgiving?
I really don't. As far as I'm concerned, the side dishes are what make Thanksgiving special and amazing and something to look forward to. So I really just don't feel like I'm missing out on anything.
Okay. But part of what I love about Thanksgiving is that it is an event. It's such a food-centric event holiday. And the turkey is the crescendo of the event. It's the centerpiece. It becomes the centerpiece of the entire table. It is an event dish. And that's where I feel like you're missing out.
I agree with you. I like the visual appeal of a turkey. I like that there is something big and impressive and eye-catching at the middle of the table. But that doesn't seem like reason enough to cook something just because it looks awesome, you know?
That's why, Laura, I've invented the veggie duckin, okay? I have this dish, which I think I've told you about before, that is a centerpiece dish, time-consuming, momentous, glorious, and all vegetarian that can bring us together. This is where we can meet in the middle.
And remind me, what are the different layers of the veggie ducking?
Well, it's
ducken. Excuse me. Veggie ducken.
It's inspired by the turducken, which, of course, is a chicken inside a duck inside a turkey with stuffing between each layer. But this is, at the core, you have sweet potatoes, then stuffing, then leeks, then stuffing. Then you put all that inside a giant banana squash, which is a squash that's about 2 feet long. It's like the biggest squash money can buy. And you cook that for a couple of hours, and then you slice it up.
and it is an event.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of it?
I think that sounds great. I can't believe I haven't tried one yet. I obviously need to make that a part of...
I'm a little hurt.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Laura Anderson, Slate readers know her as L.V. Anderson. She's Slate's food and drink editor. People can find your work at slate.com. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you, Dan. Happy Thanksgiving.
I do hope vegetarians out there will try the veggie duckin'. At one Sporkful listener, Dan Goldstein, he tried it out. He emailed me and said that it made him feel more involved in the process of creating the Thanksgiving meal than he normally gets to feel as a vegetarian. So I was happy to hear that. At this point, whether you're an omnivore or a vegetarian, I hope you're feeling ready for a fun and delicious Thanksgiving. But if you're still doubting yourself, I think I know the person to call.
Thanks for calling the Butterball Turkey Talk Line. Nicole speaking. How can I help you?
Hey, Nicole, it's Dan Pashman from The Sporkful at WNYC. How are you?
Hey, Dan. Great. How are you?
Good, good. So, I got my listeners here, and we've all been talking Thanksgiving and the do's and don'ts and having a lot of fun in the process, but it would be great if you could help us out just a little bit.
Of course. That's why we're here.
What would you say is the most common question that people call up with?
The common question that we get year after year is, how do I go about thawing my turkey?
Ah, yes, the frozen turkey problem.
So allow me to tell you the two acceptable, the safe methods. One is refrigeration method, keeping in mind it takes 24 hours for every 4 pounds of turkey meat to thaw in your refrigerator. And the other acceptable method to thaw your turkey is the cold water bath method, a shorter method, a method for folks to use if they're short on time. It's a half hour per pound.
And that's just that. And the cold water bath, you just drop the whole turkey in a bucket of cold water?
A bucket of cold water or your kitchen sink, right, leaving the wrapper on, facing it breast side down in the cold water bath, ideally changing the water every half hour or so to keep the water fresh and to continue the thawing process, will ensure your turkey's fully thawed. And then you just put it, again, wrapper intact, back in the refrigerator until you are ready to begin your roasting process.
I'm sure people ask you all the time, what's the craziest call you ever got? When you hear that question, I mean, what are some of the calls that pop into your head?
The phone call that I always like is the father or the single guy that is in the grocery store on their cell phone, and we're talking them through the whole Thanksgiving grocery shopping process. They want to know what size turkey to buy. We ask them how many guests they're having. We give them a recommendation. And then a lot of times it's, well, I know you know turkeys, but can you also help me with stuffing? Can you also help me with dessert? Can you help me with the mashed potatoes? And we just kind of walk with them as if we're there right alongside them in the grocery store.
You know, in my family, I know that people have strong opinions about the way the turkey should be cooked.
Oh, agree. Mine too.
Have you ever been in a situation where someone called you up to basically ask you to play referee?
Yes. Yes, it's usually a husband and wife.
Right.
And I'll tell the wife one thing, or I will recommend something different to the husband, and they'll say, you know what, let me put you on speaker so my husband can hear. And then, you know, you hear like this banter going back and forth, and see, she told you. And it's always pretty cute because I, too, have a strong family dynamic and very strong opinions, and I'm thinking, okay, I can empathize with this.
Do you get extra cred when there is a disagreement in your family over the way things should be cooked? Are they like, well, if Nicole says it's this way, she must be right, or will people argue with you?
Well, you know, surprisingly enough, my in-laws, my husband's family, they really listen to my advice, but it's my own family sometimes. I'll tell my dad how to carve, I'll recommend a certain way to carve or a certain way to store the leftovers. Well, they know, they've been doing it for a lot longer than I have, and so sometimes I think that, they don't listen to my advice maybe as much as they should.
Nicole Johnson in Maple Park, Illinois, mother of four, 14 years with the Butterball Turkey Talk Line at 1-800-BUTTERBALL. Thanks so much, Nicole.
Thank you.
So you see, even the Butterball Turkey lady's family argues with her. So when your family argues with you, don't feel so bad. There's one thing that every family can agree on. It's dessert. So let's talk about that. The first thing I'll say about dessert is you should wait to eat it. After Thanksgiving dinner, take a break, go for a walk, stretch the legs. Once you get back, you're going to want to put something sweet in your mouth.
My friend Brooke Gladstone from On the Media was telling me about this dessert that she makes at Thanksgiving called cracker pudding. It's got milk, sugar, coconut. I love coconut. But here's the real clincher. It has saltines. Saltines. Now, I love saltines, but I have never had them in a dessert. So I went to Brooke's house to investigate. She started by crumbling the saltines.
Okay. I'm going to just break these up. I have to say them.
Before you knew it, things went off the rails.
And by no means wash your hands, because it's all going to get burned off anyway.
That's right.
From there, it was basically one disaster after another. And it was so much fun. Here's just a small taste of the half hour or so Brooke and I spent working on the cracker pudding.
No. Oh my God, I just realized, hold this. I hope this works. Oh, and I'm supposed to add some vanilla, which I forgot. What the f***? This is now ready for a taste.
But in spite of our ups and downs, Brooke and I made it through, and it was time to eat.
Oh, man.
Brooke topped the cracker pudding with beaten egg whites that she browned in the oven. So the egg whites were kind of light and frothy on top, and then the pudding was rich and dense underneath. It was sweet and creamy and full of coconut. But then the saltines, that's what sets it apart. That's the key. So you end up with a sort of like a salted coconut pudding effect, and it was decadent.
Now you just want to eat this whole pot? I mean...
Are you going anywhere?
Brooke Gladstone is the co-host and managing editor of WNYC's On the Media. And you guys have to check out the recipe for cracker pudding and the video of Brooke and me having a ton of fun in the kitchen. It's all at sporkful.com. So you see, eaters, even when things in the kitchen go horribly, horribly wrong, the meal can still have a happy ending. Speaking of happy ending, we've reached ours. Friendly reminder, if you haven't already, please pick up a copy of my new book, Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. And remember, it's also available as an audiobook, read by me. So if you're not already completely tired of the sound of my voice, check out the audiobook. Audiobooks are like regular books, except someone else reads the book to you. That means you can read while you're driving, or walking, or cooking. Get Eat More Better, the audiobook, through Audible, iTunes, or wherever audiobooks are sold, downloaded, whatever the kids do these days. This show is a production of WNYC and The Sporkful. It's produced by Kristen Meinzer and Ann Sani. Our web writers are Talia Ralph and Alight Trong. Special thanks to Chris Bannon. And I want to say goodbye and thank you to Kristen Meinzer, who's been my producer since I came over to WNYC. She returns now to The Takeaway. Kristen did a phenomenal job. Thank you to Kristen. And I want to say welcome to our new producer, Ann Sani, or Ann Sanity, as she's apparently never, ever been called until now, but never too late to start. Welcome to Ann. We'll be back next week with the Sporkful live holiday show featuring Amy Sedaris and Radiolab's Robert Krulwich. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.